All right, welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast. Glad you could join me today, and we have two great guests lined up for you. We begin with Sarah Kustok, the longtime Nets sideline reporter who is transitioning to a new gig as the color analyst. And we talk to Sarah about how she got this job, her preparation, how she responds to some negative backlash on social media. We cover all that and more with Sarah right off the top. Next up is Nick Collison, Mr. Thunder, the guy that began his career as a Seattle Sonic and is still going strong as a member of the Thunder. I talked to Nick about the final season in Seattle, what he saw in a young Kevin Durant and a young Russell Westbrook. Nick has some great insights. We get into all that and more with him a little bit later in the pod. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. Joining me on the podcast this week, Sarah Kustok, beginning her sixth year with the Brooklyn Nets. The last five as sideline reporter. This season, she'll be the primary color analyst on the Nets games, joining our good pal Ian Eagle for these broadcasts for a fun season of Nets basketball. Right, Sarah? Fun season.
It will be fun. I'm excited to see him, but thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being
here. This is an honor. Do you know how often I listen to the podcast and all the great people you have on? And so I thought you, when you texted me to come on, it was a mistake.
The only downside, and let's get this out of the way first, the only downside to you moving to the color analyst position is means that Michael Grady comes and he's got to take over the sideline job. He is one of my nemesis. The plural of nemesis, nemesi? I don't know. One of my nemesises. And I'm not happy at all that he's going to be in the Northeast area.
Do we need to do this later? Well, can I get the backstory on Michael Grady?
I do his radio show all the time, and he thinks he's funny, and he tries to take shots, and he's never that funny, and I usually bury him at some point before the end of the show.
Chris, I got to go.
He's got a nice little 1,000-watt radio station out there in Indy. It's nice. It's a nice little mom-and-pop operation, but now he's coming east, and, you know, I told him, I texted him, like, look, man, this, I don't know if you can handle the city. You know, I don't know if you can handle this lifestyle.
We'll continue this. I'm taking him under my wing. I don't think I'll need to do that. He seems just fine.
He's a good guy, sort of. All right, so just to backtrack on you getting to this point, you were a basketball player at DePaul, right?
Right.
Grew up in the Chicago area. How good a basketball player were you?
Oh, you can't ask me questions like this.
Come on.
The worst part of all this, I don't like talking about myself.
Come on.
And I'll talk trash to people. Like, I'll joke around like, hey, I could beat you one-on-one or I don't truly feel that way anymore. I was fine. I was decent. Our team did well. We got to the tournament, top 25.
You know, I've heard tales. I've heard tales of your skill on the road.
Believe the tales.
Stephen Bondi is on Twitter all the time talking about your skills.
Yeah, but what kind of competition is Steph Bondi really?
That's true.
I'm joking. No, it was a good. I had a good run. Mm-hmm. I had a good run. I will say the thing about this. I was always the player that understood I needed to be in the best condition possible. I needed to know every position, know every play. I was always a student of the game. And for me, I was certainly not the best athlete that was on the floor. But so that, I think, when I think about what translates into doing this job, like to me, I always was big in studying the game, studying personnel, things like that.
And that's what took you into coaching, right? Right after you finished, did you want to be a coach?
No, I was all over the board.
Yeah.
And so I started grad school.
Like any 20-something would be.
Didn't have a clue.
I wanted to be on The Real World. That was my dream in life.
On The Real World?
I sent in four.
No,
in
my, you didn't.
Four tapes.
Get out of here.
My junior year,
Do we have those tapes?
They're VHS, so I don't think they're still.
I still have a VHS player.
My junior year, though, I told them I was a struggling gay artist. I did. I was desperate to get on that show. I would have done anything.
Did you do anything to your hair?
No,
tattoos?
It wasn't a very good tape. I didn't really pull it off. I just sort of, I took
four tapes though.
Four tapes, freshman year to senior year. I wanted to be on the show. My life's ambition. Didn't work out.
There's still a The Real World still exists? Real World, like 97?
They do, but I think that when you're in your mid-30s, it kind of
maybe that could be the catch.
Like Real World mid-30s edition?
Like I'm actually successful in the real world, but I want to be on this reality
But the whole
show.
Goal from The Real World is to go and drink the whole time and, you know.
Is that still your aspiration? You could probably do that.
I can do that now. Just more, I want to do it while somebody paid me to do it. I live in a cool house. I mean, you know what college lifestyle is like.
Yeah, absolutely. So those weren't the line of my lack of direction. But
right.
But I didn't. I went to college. I was focused on basketball. I always cared about my education. Mm-hmm. But I started grad school my senior year corporate multicultural communication. I wanted to get, I love to speak. I love to research, to read. And it, I found myself, when I was finishing up my master's, I started calling some high school games, some college games. And then I eventually took a production runner job for Big Ten football games mm-hmm. with ESPN and saw what happened in the truck. And when I sat in a TV truck and actually understood when we're out there playing as athletes in the way the broadcast is put together, I was blown away.
Mm-hmm.
What? But so I ended up starting to dabble in, and as you know, you're living off paycheck to paycheck and eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every night. But so I started to dabble with doing a lot of freelance work, seeing what games I could get. And then after, I would say, a few months of doing that was when the assistant job opened up at DePaul.
Mm-hmm.
And so my coach said, hey, look, the season's about to start. You know our system. We think we're going to be good. The team ended up going to the Sweet 16 that year. He said, would you consider coming in coaching, at least for this season? And so at that time, I literally could not pay my bills. this seems like some good timing.
What was the assistant coach job at DePaul paying at that time?
Am I allowed to say that?
Sure. It's a long time ago
So this Doug Bruno, my coach, who I think the world of, he was calling me, and the premise was like, look, I can't pay you much. I know you're not going to want to take this because it's such a small salary. So he's really building this up like I'm going to make no money. And he told me, I believe it was $39,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm a millionaire. That felt at the time like so much money. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I think that could work, coach. I think I could deal with that. Mm-hmm. But given what I was trying to do and put together, I was like, oh, I have a regular paycheck and I know I'm going to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just funny how things change. So I don't know what the DePaul assistant coaches make right now, so I don't want to assume that.
Did you get the coaching bug, though, doing that?
I did. And it actually, so the situation, to backtrack, and not to go too deep into it, Maggie Dixon, sister of Jamie Dixon, who she had left to take the head job at Army. She was 28 years old. It was a huge coaching opportunity for her. She ended up taking Army to their first NCAA tournament, the Army women's basketball team, and died in April. And but because of that, and Maggie, of course, she was my assistant coach, and we all always thought the world of her, but that was part of the reason Doug was, he wanted her to go, wanted her to continue growing and taking on her own team. But it was right before, you know, training camp was starting and things were starting with his team. So that's why it was important for me to step in and do that. I, of course, loved him and loved the team. But when I look at the course of coaching and recruiting, I loved that. Mm-hmm. I loved a chance to watch some of these young, talented players. And to me, that translated a lot into what I wanted to do with TV and what I do now, because you're just soaking up the game and, mm-hmm. and you're really getting entrenched with a team and with players and what they're trying to do. So I did. But at the same token, I figured I could always maybe come back to coaching. I thought that my TV career might have had a shorter window. And so after that season, I got back to TV.
So there wasn't another job that you were like eyeballing after DePaul, like that you could have taken and moved, like, because the coaches in your position move around the country. These guys live a crazy lifestyle.
Right.
They're in Kalamazoo, and I mean, they're just, that never sort of was on your radar.
No, I've thought about it throughout mm-hmm. the course of my television career. I think shortly after that, I would have stayed at DePaul longer if I was going to continue coaching. But I would say there's been many points throughout my television career that I thought would see an opportunity or talk to some people and think, oh, would I ever want to get back into coaching?
Mm-hmm.
I do. It's not for me right now, but I would never close the book and say that's not something that I would do.
So you're quite polished and quite accomplished on the air now, but we've all had awful moments on the air. Give me your worst on-air moment.
Worst on-air moment. Do you want a bad off-air moment?
Give me both.
Still, well, I'm trying to think. I had countless numbers of bad on-air moments, especially early on. I shudder and think about, I don't know why any employer rehired me after seeing some of the early stuff. I will say, I'll first go to my off-air moment because this stands out so much to me. I was covering the White Sox, and I had been covering, I'm not sure what year it was that I was I had been covering them. So familiar with a lot of the players. Ozzie Guillen is still the manager, colorful character. Fantastic, though. And I'm trying to think of the other player. You know, it's the A.J. Pierzynski, Paul Konerko, Gordon Beckham. And it was a Sunday. It was a getaway day. I'm wearing a pair of, I think I just had to do like one quick, you know, post-game wrap. So I had on sneakers and a pair of cargo shorts and, you know, whatever. And so we were in the locker room after the game and I'm, you know, kind of doing some things, whatever, trying to wait for my next interview. And Ozzy walks by and he dropped accidentally, but, you know, dropped some paper or something. So I bend down to pick it up and my shorts rip from the top all the way down to the bottom of the shorts. I claimed it was because they were old. I do think they were really old. But needless to say, shorts whipped right open. And I'm sitting there. I think it was Paul or AJ that tossed me into a locker. Gordon got some of his shorts. But to me, that was like, man, how do you rip your shorts in a clubhouse? But yeah, that was, you learn from that. Mm-hmm. And I got to wear some basketball shorts.
I was going to say, did they give you uniform? Like a half
yeah,
a uniform to
yeah,
put on?
Yeah, I had okay. to wear it. Yeah, they were some of their training shorts. On air moment? I need to think.
It's pretty good that you can't think of it on the top of your head.
No, because I just feel like I've messed up so many times. Oh,
okay, so it's just too many. All right.
Yeah. Nothing that really stands out. I also think you got to, as you know in this business, like you kind of just got to have a thick skin. Like when things happen. You got to roll with it.
Yeah.
A lot of people know about, I was covering the Chicago Blackhawks and I was doing one of our like mid period on ice interviews and an individual, professed their love to me. And it didn't seem that awkward to me at the time until I walked in to the dressing room after the game to do some post game, interviews and the players had all heard it, seen it. That was when social media was just picking up, and I got ragged on about that for at least weeks, good month. Yeah, so.
So how did you get hooked up with the Nets?
My agent. Mm-hmm. My agent had.
But did you want to do basketball again, or because you said you'd be doing a lot of hockey, a lot of.
You know what? I didn't think. So I was doing a mix. I was working in Chicago and covering all the professional sports there and doing a mix of everything. I think the Nets job was so intriguing to me with the Yes Network because it was their move to Brooklyn. And so I do think there was a part of me that always wanted to get back into being more specific covering the NBA. I do enjoy covering a lot of sports, but I think more than anything, it was a situation where the Nets were moving to Brooklyn. It was an NBA team in New York. There was a part of me that always wanted to be in the New York market. And so I got a chance to kind of have this combination of all things coming together, an exciting move for the NBA and just the attention around that team. And it seemed like a perfect fit.
But you, while you were doing sideline, you mixed in some color stuff, right?
Right, right. So that was a quirk that happened. So it was three seasons ago. That would have been my, I can't even do the math. Yeah, third season that I was covering the team. And all of our color analysts had other obligations. And it was a game in March at Philadelphia. And so my producer, Frank DeGrace, who was very familiar with how I prep for games, and the knowledge that I had about the team and just the league, he had brought up to me, he said, I'll talk to our executive producer, John Filippelli, but he's like, I'd really like to put you on this game as our analyst. How do you feel about that with Ian? And so naturally, I was like, it'd be incredible. But I thought that was kind of a one-off that, yeah, this is cool. The scheduling is not really working out. You go do the game. Someone had asked about the tape and I'm like, I remember distinctly watching it shortly after doing the game, but I don't ever want to hear it again because I can't remember how it went exactly.
But, did you finish it though, feeling like you did well in...
I don't normally finish many broadcasts feeling like I did well. I mean, like it's solid, but I was like, oh, it's solid. I didn't feel terrible about it. It wasn't a train wreck. Yeah. I felt like it was at least
it's like a B grade, it was not a listenable. Train wreck.
Yeah, but no, but I thought it went fairly well. Mm-hmm. And with that being said, then the following season, so I thought it was an incredible experience, loved doing it, but didn't think much more would progress with that. And during the time I've been doing women's college basketball, analyst work, also doing for the WNBA. So in my mind, I love doing that, but it was like, okay, I'll get my fix doing color analysts on the W or the women's college game. And then, and of course, my love for the NBA, I can continue working the sidelines with that. Well, the following season, they had given me an opportunity to do a few more games. And then last season, quite a few more. So it continued to snowball to grow, and they kind of were putting me in that lane of you can do more analyst work, and we'd like to have you on the broadcast. And then obviously things this off season changed dramatically, and thrilled about the opportunity to be able to do this all the time.
When you're preparing for that type of role, it's a role across the NBA traditionally held by ex-players or a former coach who's been around the NBA for a long time. You obviously have your own basketball experience. How much of that do you lean on versus, say, you know, just asking around and leaning on coaches and scouts or whatever that your preparation is?
I think you hugely lean on coaches and scouts and other people. I think that's a major factor in why I was able to get this opportunity, because I think that's a part as well of report. You start to create relationships and connections and learn more about the players and the teams. So I think it's a combination of everything. Heading into last season, I was starting to get the bug to do more color and do more analyst work. So I prepared for every game last season as though I was calling the game. I'd make my boards, I'd watch the film, you know, I'd go through things as though I was going to be the analyst on the game, whether I was the analyst or whether I was doing the sideline. I think that prep work obviously got my mind in a different space of how I looked at the game and watched it. But I think more than anything, to your point, it is talking to coaches, talking to scouts. Tell me about this guy. What do you see in this player? How this team plays, strategy, what they're doing with their schemes or systems or rotations. So I think it's a combination of all those things. And in ways I look at it, of course, I have a basketball background, but to your point, a lot of it is ex-players, ex-coaches. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think you could relate it to, you know, coaches who didn't play in the NBA, but what kind of preparation and study do they do to put their players in the best position to succeed? And I think for our jobs, it's how, what are we trying to do? We're trying to inform and entertain the viewers. So what can I do to prepare to make sure I am an informative, insightful, and entertaining for our viewers?
You really have to lean. I think even ex-coaches or ex-players and coaches don't lean sometimes enough on, like, I mean, I always tell people on the Celtics broadcast, I don't have an original thought in my head. Like, I go I go across the street and I ask the assistant coach on the other team, what's your game plan? And then I say, you know, don't be surprised to see Michael Kidd-Gilchrist running high screen and roll here. And, oh, look, he ran high screen. Like, you know, I don't have an original thought. Like, it's better to be accurate and be like...
But that's true, because you don't know, because here's the thing. Like, regardless of what I think and whether I played or I coached or... I don't know what the team is trying to do. I haven't watched hours and hours. I don't have, you know, three guys that are film guys putting together clips and highlights. So I don't know. And every coach in the NBA is different on how they approach things or how they attack different teams. So for me to think that I have an idea about something that I haven't even come close to the amount of preparation is, to your point, a coach or an assistant, it's crazy to think about. Or even players and just understanding how they play. We're not sitting in every minute of every practice or every film session. So that, I think, is just such a major part of having those relationships and understanding, you know, how much you can lean on those people to be a resource in being accurate in how you're describing what's happening.
You know, as you know, whether you're doing a sideline report or color commentary, these coaches and even the players, they watch and, like, they see it back. And what kind of feedback have you gotten over the years, specifically in the color commentary role, from the team, players, whatnot?
It's been very positive. And to me, that's been the biggest factor in how I judge the job I have done or what I'm doing or what I need to do. And I think I feel so thankful for the coaching staffs and especially a lot of the assistant coaches with this Brooklyn Nets organization. Obviously, there's been plenty of turnover and changes, but those are the people that have come, hey, I listened to you last night. I didn't realize you were doing the game. This was good. This was good. We were trying to do this here, but just coming back with a lot of feedback of what they heard, how they heard it, and even just things that they said, like, you were wrong here. Like that, you know, this guy was supposed to be here. This is what we were giving up on this play. We wanted them to be taking these open shots.
That Which wasn't, is constructive. I mean, that's...
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, oh, so next time this is... Because that's it's such a nuanced game, and game plans are so nuanced that you don't know. You may think, oh, this guy's not closing out hard. Well, maybe they want that guy taking an outside shot and not... So it's been positive. And to me, that's my biggest judgment of, do I have the respect of the coaches, of the players, of those listening and understanding to be sitting in that seat and doing that role?
When they offered you the color commentary role, were you expecting it? Were you blown away? I mean, what was your...
No, I was shocked. I was shocked. And I was hoping that I would get an opportunity to do more games this season and have more analyst games, but I did not think it would be... to be the primary analyst, and I was humbled and very grateful, and I think it's a big responsibility. People have asked, do you feel pressure? Do you feel? I think it's a responsibility, and I think twofold: one for those people and at the Yes Network and Ian Eagle, Ryan, mm-hmm. you know, the guys I'm working with, to make sure that I am at the level and the competency that they are at, and just how incredible that they are. And two, you know, being a female doing this. For the next generation, for other young girls to be able to have these type of opportunities, I think you need to make sure that you are at the best in your game and prepared and ready.
Social media being the home of all rational discourse at all times, what kind of feedback have you... how much negative feedback do you get when you do stuff like this?
Shockingly, I guess we'll see once the season starts the games go. Teeing me up, Chris. You're teeing me up.
Guy out there listening going, oh, I'm going to go at that Kustak.
Just wait. And I'm certain that will happen because it does... As you know, with anything, but overall, the positive feedback, and more so from colleagues and from our peers, from those in the industry, I've appreciated more than I can even say, just their excitement, enthusiasm, and support about it. And that's what means the world to me. I think for others, I haven't had a lot of negative feedback, mm-hmm. but I'm also not super active on social media. You may know this, but I think it's a space where you look at it. I don't think I check it all that often. You kind of skim through and see, and you appreciate those people who you know or who you work with or whose opinion you respect within the business. But I think after that, it's a little hit or miss, but I do think it will be more interesting to see once the season actually starts.
I love negative feedback. I love the troll. Oh, I love it. There's this woman in Boston who... has, among other things, I think she called me once last year the equivalent of getting punched in the eardrum. I believe that was, and my friends from Boston, like my five or six friends, they follow her on social media. And every time she goes at me, they just like the crap out of it. And she doesn't know. I don't respond to her. She doesn't know.
You don't respond. No, so you're not someone that loves the trolls and responds.
Oh, no. But I love it when like that. It's like the mean tweets on like Jimmy Kimmel. Like I love that kind of stuff. Like say like, come on, bring it on.
Do you block anyone ever?
No. Mute, yes. Mute. When they get a little, there's like a line, you know, it's like racial or really bad. But if you're just telling me I suck, I'm good with that. Like, go right ahead.
I'm going to start tweeting at Chris. Like,
Nets Celtics, nice job. I said that half an hour earlier.
Who is this guy? Who is this guy? I can't listen to him.
So is this going to be, I mean... Not to get too deep into your business, but is it a multi-year type of thing? What's the plan with the color stuff going forward?
It will be multi-year, mm-hmm. yeah. So hopefully, at least I have an opportunity. I think hopefully I don't fall flat on my face this first year and they keep me around. But that is the plan. And I think with that, the opportunity to grow, to build chemistry with a guy like Ian, doing mm-hmm. games with Ryan Rucco, growing with the team that's young and has a young core, that will be... that will be the plan.
What do you, when you say like growing chemistry, what does it take to develop a chemistry with a play-by-play guy?
I think that's one of the most underrated things. When you listen to people or listen to people on a broadcast, whatever sport it is, I think that's one of the most underrated things when you're starting to listen to people work together. And Ian Eagle, I can't go on enough about what a pro he is, how just impeccable he is in how he has a flow within a game and a rhythm, his calls, his preparation, knowing everything about every player, coach, team. And he does that type of preparation for each and every game. And he's a guy who which I'm thrilled about because I've gotten to call many games with him now and have a great rapport on air. I think for us too, the chemistry off the air, he's one of my dearest friends. And so I think that translates. When you sincerely like someone and enjoy being around them and working with them, I think viewers can hear that and feel that on the air. And some of the best teams, broadcast teams, are those who genuinely enjoy one another. But I think it's just the rhythms of a game, getting in, getting out, knowing when. And Ian's a guy who his calls are off the charts, but understanding when he's finished, when he's taking a pause, that is a part of his call. And so I think it's just small things like that, that the more that you do games, you get a rhythm. And in each game is different, as you know, the tempo of each game is different and just kind of how choppy it becomes with fouls or timeouts or whatnot. So I think that's all a part of just getting used to it. And I think we've already established that with these past few years of me calling games with him. But I do think that's a part that will take some time.
Do you study other color analysts in your position in terms of seeing how they do the job? I mean, you're in a different position as these guys are ex-players, ex-coaches, whatever, but do you study their techniques? What do you take from
other ones? Absolutely. Because I think you have so much freedom within a broadcast of where are you going on this play? Are you breaking down the play? Is it big picture about the game? Are you telling an anecdote here? I mean, there's people that I watch and that have very different styles than you. Of course, Doris Burke is someone I watch, but mm-hmm. you look at Jeff Van Gundy or Mark Jackson, how they do that, just different, you know, so many of the local broadcasts and listen, you're watching League Pass all the time. You're watching these other teams. Listen to what are they bringing in here? How much are they talking about anecdotes, stories about the game, about this game, big picture about the league? And so I think that's things that you start to pick up in how they describe things or what they are talking about given the time and score of a game.
You should just adopt Tommy Heinsohn style. Go at referees and
but that's the thing, like everyone, and Tommy, of course, the legend. Who has been, but everyone has their own way and has their own thing. And some people, like, if you would translate, if I said everything that Tommy Heinsohn said in a I would get fired.
Oh,
I
mean, done. No.
Within a minute. And maybe that's a bad comparison, but just so many other different peoples. You need your own style. You need to be you. But I think it's important to listen to other people and just how they do things or how they're describing things to help you.
I've said this before. Tommy's like, he's the only guy in your position, your business, in that business, that's basically allowed to have a production meeting on the air. That he can, I remember I was doing sideline for a game, and I've told the story before, but I was doing sideline for a game. They were playing Denver a couple of years ago, and I'm sitting there across, and I'm listening into the broadcast in my earpiece, and Tommy on the air is talking to Mike Gorman about Jokic and Nurkic, and he's kind of like, which one's that guy? Which one is that? Like, who, Jokic? Is that Nurkic? Oh, yeah, he's figuring that out. It was unintentional comedy to the highest level. I was dying across
and
the court.
And he's
listening
dead
to that.
Serious.
He's dead serious. But that's just him. He's amazing. His anecdotes are unbelievable during these broadcasts.
Spectacular. But that's the thing. And that's even the thing about, you know, some individuals mispronouncing a name or being funny about, like, some things are endearing and charming and funny for someone. If I'm mispronouncing names,
oh yeah,
that's not good. Yeah. Like but so there's,
that's when the social media hordes will circle.
Yes, but in that's just, you know, one point of a lot of things. But I think it's so important, just even if you're not actually replicating how someone does something, mm-hmm. just to see all the different ways.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions about the Nets, who you're going to have to be. Been a rough couple of years for them the last few years. Are you sensing that the coaching change and moving away from let's try to win immediately, how has that changed the culture over there?
I think when I talk about the Nets, people think, oh, it's because you cover the team and, you know, you're just a supporter of the team. It is real. It is palpable how the culture has shifted immediately since the start of last season. And you give credit to Sean Marks, the guys he's brought in, Kenny Atkinson, his coaching staff, but just the way that they run things, how they do things, they put the players first, taking care of players, families. It goes beyond just how they're practicing or what they're doing on the court to how they take care of guys in the community, what they have them doing, giving back to the community and to Brooklyn. But with that being said, most of the guys were in Brooklyn the entire summer off season, working out together, wanting to be in the gym, wanting to get better. And so I think there's just a shift in the attitude and the mentality. in understanding the expectations may not be high to win, but the type of expectations are, how hard are we going to play? And are you going to show up? And are you going to get better? There was a push for improvement. And I think that changes the perspective of everything.
It's so hard for a new franchise and a community to connect with that community, no matter how good you are. It doesn't matter what your record is. I mean, what the Nets need are the five-year-olds that are in Brooklyn that are like, oh, they don't know anything else. I'm a Nets fan. They need those people to be able to buy tickets someday. So it might take a whole generation for them to really draw crowds out there.
And I think that's something that the organization is now understanding. Yeah. Sean Marks 100% gets, because he did come from the San Antonio Spurs. He saw the way that things were built, the point they got it to, paying attention to details. And I don't think there is an expectation of, oh, we need to win X number of games this year, but it's more about the style of play. It's more about the character of players. And I think that is what will hopefully and eventually attract other players, other free agents to say, hey, this is a place I want to come play at because of the guys on the team, because of the staff, and because of the way that they treat their players.
How do you approach, I mean, look, their best case scenario is, well, honestly, it's probably 25, 30 wins. It just is what it is when you're a rebuilding team. When you're into the dog days and you're in January, February, I mean, how do you approach those types of games when they've got to play a Golden State or a Cleveland and it's a rough night? I mean, what's your kind of mindset there?
You know what I'll say? And I look at last year as an example. And I continue to say it, but it really was the amount of effort that they gave every game. There was a stretch, and I'm forgetting.
Oh, they played
it,
hard
I
all
think,
season.
And I think I blacked out on it because it was. But there was, I think January and February, they won maybe two games in the course of 2 months. I mean, there was stretches where there was not a win to be seen, but every game was a relatively close game. They kept themselves in the game. It's a 8-point, even against some of the better teams, 8-point game in the fourth quarter. So I think, you know, from the broadcast side of things, it's easier to call a game with the style they play. They're up-tempo, they move the ball, taking a lot of threes. Even if they're not winning these games, you can still feel that type of energy, which makes it easier. And I think for the players, and you look at this season, there's going to be a lot of competition for minutes. There's going to be a lot of players that you got an eye on, like a D'Angelo Russell, who, how does he translate and really does he take that next step in this third year of his NBA career? Jeremy Lin didn't play for much of last season. What can he do? There was so much hype around him coming in and playing with the Brooklyn Nets. We almost get to redo that here in this second season. And you look at other players, but what kind of jump can they make? There's so many young guys that I think just trying to take a look at how they continue to improve will be, at least from our perspective, exciting to see.
Do you get misty-eyed staring at Brooke Lopez's locker at this point?
Oh, Chris.
Mr. Net. For people who don't know, no. Sarah and Brooke Lopez had a bond. Those two were tight.
He was just one. You know, because it's funny when he is just one of the best human beings. But when I came to the Nets, he had been with, you know, obviously one of the many. But as things changed year after year, he was that one consistent. They would always show up. He'd always talk to you, shoot around, always talk to you after the game. He was a class act, and he did so many great things for the Nets. And I hope he has incredible success in LA. And I think it's good for him to be back. California kid, be back on the West Coast. But that was an awesome move. Mm-hmm. It was one that was necessary. And Sean Marks, I thought, just did a tremendous job in getting what he could to get a talent like D'Angelo Russell in the gym for these guys. And Mozgov has been very solid so far. And he, I would assume, will be the starting center for this team to get a first-round draft pick. So, you know, things change. Everything changes sometimes, Chris, but for the better. But of course, Brooke was wonderful. And those are the players you appreciate, from the media standpoint, that will always be considerate in when they're giving you conversation and time.
On the other side of that, you had to cover Kevin Garnett for years, and there probably is no more difficult player in the NBA to cover than Kevin Garnett.
I would, you know what I'll say though, and maybe it's a little different from a team broadcast side of things. When he spoke, because occasionally, had
occasionally
to wait a while for him.
When Gary Sussman could drag him out of the locker room in the shower.
Well, we're like, gosh, the game ended an hour ago. Do we think he's coming out still?
You guys had it bad with, I mean, Boston had those two guys too, but Kevin and Paul were just never, I mean.
But they were so good when they spoke.
So if you wait them out,
it's like if you wait them out and those guys, they were respectful to be around. They were great to deal with. Kevin Garnett, he went to Farragut. So we had a little bit of a Chicago connection. So that helped me out off the bat. But they were, when they spoke to you, just the type of sound bites they gave you or the depth of their interviews or the honesty that they would put in, to me, that outweighs anything else. Because I'm like, this is real things that people want to hear, that I care about hearing. And they were, you know, they were a little bit unique in their character, but I take it.
KG was tough. As a national guy, KG was tough. I got to the point where I was bribing him with Boardwalk Empire DVDs. Through boxing, he's a huge Boardwalk Empire guy, was when he was on. So through boxing, I get HBO connections, and I was able to get like advanced copies of the season. So I would come in like September, October, and like hook him up with Boardwalk Empire DVDs.
Did you tell him hey, if I give you this, wink, wink.
He asked me once. It was the first year that the team was at Duke when they all kind of came together. And I had Paul, because I'd known Paul for a long time. And I had Paul like just really elaborating on Kevin and the whole thing, like how he talked to Kevin and how he was able to, you know, to convince him to stay active. And he was just really deep and insightful. I just needed like 5 minutes. So that was the one time that KG was like, what do I got to do for this? And I was like, nothing, no big deal. Just trying to help you guys. I know you're a fan, so I'm just trying to help you out.
And then
I just have a couple minutes. Then I kind of tail him. I got like, I want to get like 2 minutes with him, which is really all you can hope for with Kevin Garnett. Like you, like alone for 2 minutes, like that's the best you can possibly do.
I think the one thing I remember, because we do our preseason sit downs.
Yeah.
Prior to training camp for our preview show, and so we would sit down everyone, and we sat down Kevin. And normally these interviews are anywhere from like 20 minutes to a half hour for guys. Sat down, good to meet you, et cetera, et cetera. And I think our producer, Frank, had said, just so you know, this is for big picture on the season, start of the season, but we'll use parts of this interview throughout the entire year. So it's a little longer than normal. And I'm forgetting the exact words, but I feel like he pretty much was like, I'll let you know. let you know when it's over.
Was there an expletive in there?
You're not going to tell me when it's over. I'll let you guys know when I'm done. But he was fantastic. He was great.
When he gets going, he can be great.
Right. And if you're talking about things that he wants to talk about, then he's... When we went that season, we took a trip to... We played in London. We played the Atlanta Hawks in London. And so he set up a tour and to see all the facilities of, it was Chelsea, right? It's Chelsea.
I don't know. Yeah.
I should know things better. And I went, No. It wasn't Man U. I don't think it was Man U, but it was Chelsea. But he's an enormous soccer fan. And he apparently with his boys in the off season that was part of his training as a soccer field in Minnesota. So they would play soccer. So he was like a little kid in a candy shop watching and looking and seeing all this stuff. And it was those situations where then when we're riding on the bus there, he would talk forever about soccer or his love or growing up. And so when you got him at the right spots.
Did you ever have, because it's in the news now, did you ever have kind of a Cam Newton moment where somebody said to you like it's...
I was thinking about that a lot since that obviously just occurred. And talk about disappointing. No, not that I could recall, and certainly not that blatant or belittling.
Basketball players seem like they're more progressive.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And basketball players not. And I don't even think, I think in any situations, we've probably all been in situations where, whether it's players or coaches or maybe do not answer our questions in the most polite fashion. But I've never...
doesn't matter.
And that's why... the thing. Yeah. Like, it's not because you're a woman or you're a female or this or that. Like, right. So, no. I definitely do not recall anything of that nature. And I do think NBA players are just so much more progressive in how they think and what they think. And I even feel that way when I've called games and in many occasions the last couple seasons... Our players haven't, you're doing the game today, cool. Like, it has never even registered to them that it should be something that's a little different, that I was sitting in a different seat.
And you probably want, you probably want them to be critical. Like, if they disagree, come at me. Give it to me.
That's the best part about it. And that's what you would want, because you don't want people to sugarcoat things. Yeah. If you're trying to be good at what you're doing, and I think we're all that way, you want to hear what they have to say. And to your point, I think that's man, woman, it doesn't matter what it is. You want that from players to have that type of respect for you to try and help you get things right to be better.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, good luck. I'll be watching League Pass.
Please do.
Yes.
I wish I would have known. Boardwalk Empire is not my thing, but I wish I would have known that I could have.
It's all about you. Gotta, like,
bribed about.
Poke the agents. Like, what's his thing? Like, if he likes food, you bring him like a Knish or some kind. I don't know.
I would have brought you something. Brooke Lopez bobblehead.
Brooke Lopez. I'm disappointed, Brooke. He told me in summer. I saw him at Summer League, and I was like, "How you fit in L.A.?" He's like, "Well, I left all my stuff in Jersey. I don't know how to get it out." Like, it was something along those lines, like, or wherever he was living out here.
Yeah.
That sounds like you, Brooke.
Very
that
simple. Sounds, like, we'll figure it out. I'll wear the same t-shirt.
Well, welcome to the Vertical Podcast family there, Sarah. We appreciate you coming in.
It was an honor. Thanks for having me, Chris.
All right. So before I get to Nick Collison, let's talk a little bit about Bombfell. So I have no sense of style. None. I buy jeans because, I don't know, I see actors wearing a particular brand on TV, and I actually once bought an entire suit off a mannequin. That's a true story. This is why I need Bombfell. Bombfell is an easier way for men to get better clothes. You complete a simple questionnaire and then are matched one-to-one with a dedicated personal stylist. They never charge above retail price. They offer free shipping and returns, convenient home try-on, and the ability to preview and edit your stylist picks before your order ships. Bombfell is an easier way for men to get better clothes. Everything is fully personalized. Every piece has been handpicked for you by your own stylist. Your stylist will email you his or her selections, after which you'll have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. You are in total control here. Then, when you receive the clothes, you have 7 days to tell them what you want to keep. Send the rest back. They are completely flexible. You can receive clothes when you want and can pause or cancel anytime. So tell them about yourself, your measurements, and your style preferences. Set your budget limits that you're comfortable with. Set up your order. Tell them what you want in your next order and schedule what you want. Or, you know, let them surprise you. Your stylist will then put together your clothing picks and send you a preview email. You can cancel or change anything you don't like. They will ship after 48 hours otherwise. You have 7 days to try on your shipments delivered before they charge your credit card, pay for what you keep, and return all the rest. Shipping, free both ways. I tried this, and I have to tell you, it was fantastic. The service was easy. The quality of the clothes was great. I am sold. I'm in a fall clothes shopping mode right now. It's not easy, and I'm going to use Bombfell to help me get through all of it. Here's what I want you to do. Go to bombfell.com/Mannix and give this service a try. That's bombfell.com/Mannix. We negotiated with Bombfell to get a great offer for my listeners. Visit bombfell.com/Mannix for $25 off your first purchase. That's bombfell.com/Mannix. One more time, so you don't miss out on any of this amazing offer, go to bombfell.com/Mannix. Bombfell, open and clothes. Joining me on the podcast is Nick Collison, Oklahoma City forward, who just corrected me on how long he's been, like 15 seasons, correct, Nick?
Yes, I've been getting paychecks as an NBA player for 15 years. My stats say 14 because I missed a year with injury.
Part of the vaunted draft class of 03, when history records it, it's LeBron, Carmelo, Nick Collison.
Yes, and then the second tier, Bosh, Wade.
Everybody out there. Did you think you'd play this long when you came into the NBA?
Not really. I mean, I was hoping to have a long career. I basically came into the NBA and wanted to have a career that, you know, I felt like I had a, you know, 10 year, I didn't know how many years on it, but I wanted to, like, stick. And, I really wasn't sure what was going to be in store for my career. I grew up, it seemed like a long shot to ever play in the, I always wanted to, but, where I come from, the best player ever at our school, Billy Fisher, played Division II. And so it seemed far-fetched. But, I mean, to play 15, I've been, you know, really blessed to find a niche, find a place here where they recognize my value and appreciate what I do and stayed healthy and for the most part. And it's gone well.
15 years all with one franchise. Started in Seattle when they were out there. How many pairs of things of Sonics gear do you have?
I wish I would have kept more. I have a lot. I keep a lot of stuff at my parents' house in the basement, so I'll have to go through it all. But I remember when I was I was one of the few players that would live there in the summer. And I remember that summer when the team was leaving and they had just piles of it that they were getting rid of. I wish I would have taken a lot more.
That stuff's hard to find now. Like, yeah, I wear only
like never existed.
I wear only defunct sports teams. I'm wearing a Minnesota North Stars t-shirt right now.
Okay.
I've tried to find quality Sonics gear. It's hard to find, yeah. Man. Yeah, it's like, not out there.
Yeah. That stuff is, it's, there's not a lot of it. I got a few things, and it's all huge because like the stuff was so big in, you know, early 2000s.
Nothing
it's
really like, fit yeah, then. It was all yeah, just
right,
baggy
right.
all over you. When you came into the NBA, you came in as a scorer from college. You were an 18-point guy in your last season. Are you still the Big 12 leading scorer there? I mean, I know you graduated.
I don't think so. I think somebody passed me.
But you were a high-level scorer yeah. back then. When you came to the NBA, were you thinking, I'm going to be this guy. I'm still going to be able to be this guy. And if you were, like, when did things kind of evolve for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, like I said earlier, I really wasn't sure. I think if I had a little different mindset, it might have been a more confident player. I was a little bit unsure of myself. And I would say that I was always a guy that I had like a healthy fear of like, I got to do everything I can to play well in this league. Cause this is the NBA. Like I kind of put it on a pedestal. This is a place that I always wanted to play. And it was seemed almost a little far fetched to be there, even though I had a lot of success in college. I think that helped me and it hurt me. I think it hurt me. And I wasn't always as confident as I could have been and just, you know, open, shoot the ball and just play. But it also made me really ready to play every day, every night and could really focus and play extremely hard because I knew I felt like I had to do well. So I missed my first year with injury, and I think that affected me also. So when I came back, I was adjusting to a full year off and adjusting to play at the NBA at the same time. And I just remember not being it just felt a little bit off. I used to really wheel and deal inside in college, and just my feet weren't really underneath me and trying to score, you know, trying to shoot hook shots over Jerome James, who's 7'2" instead of some 6'7" guy at Kansas State. It was just, I realized that stuff was going to be harder for me. And I knew that if I could do the other things really well, I could still get on the court. And we had Nate McMillan, who I really liked as a coach. He was a hard nosed guy, really fair. And if I could screen for Ray Allen, if I could defend, rebound, do the dirty work, I could play. And I played a lot as a rookie. And by the end of the year, I was playing a lot in the playoffs. And I just kind of found a niche. And I think it was good for me to be able to adapt. I think like that's a huge thing in NBA is being able to figure out what you can do and find a niche. And so I guess in that first year, I just kind of became more of a dirty work defender, rebounder type player.
Do you set your mind to screening in particular? I mean, you've played for a lot of guys over the years that come off screens and play at the beginning with Ray. I mean, is there, what's the tricks of the trade there? I mean, how do you practice becoming a great screener?
Well, I've played with like great scorers and great perimeter scorers in my career. We ran a lot of stuff for Ray. I think, you know, I was taught well. My dad was a high school coach. We talk about stuff like that growing up. I don't think a lot of kids ever think about it until they maybe get to college, like how to set a screen. And I just learned to, I guess, trying to get an advantage. You're trying to get the ball a head start. So a lot of it could be running into the screen. If you can really run into the screen and get some separation from your man, he's not going to be in his coverage. And then that guy can have some daylight and get the ball going to the middle, and then something good's going to happen. So just kind of understanding what the goal of the play is and trying to figure out ways to, you know, get into it, get a good hit on the guy. And I don't know, it's just over time, you just kind of figure it out, I guess.
Can you tell when you've gotten a good hit on a guy?
Yeah, for sure. And I can tell when I'm going to be able to, because you can tell the guy's not ready or the guy's not aware, not in the coverage. And then you know something good's going to happen, especially when you're setting it for, you know, a great score, you know, Russell, James Harden, Durant, Ray Allen. You know, I've played with a lot of these guys that's a valuable part of the team to be able to get those guys open, get those guys shots.
When you have a good screen and a guy goes down, do you just sort of look down at him sometimes?
Or I
just
love that. The best is when there's kind of like a, I don't know if I can do the sound, but just like a oof, like you knock the wind out of them. That's those are my favorite, when you kind of just take that guy's breath away if you can get him. Someone used to call it taking off his lung. Mm-hmm. Like someone, take his lung, as Perk probably said that.
I could see Perk saying that. Right, yeah. Right. Because that's another guy that decided, like, early in his career, like, I've got to be a screener or rebounder. And got a long career out of it, mm-hmm, too.
Absolutely. And he was in a place where execution was big in Boston. And so, like...
Same player, Ray Allen.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I think, like, for me, also another thing, too, is, like, when you have a team that is, like, a higher executing team, a team that's at a point where they're trying to win in the playoffs, you can find your niche and your role a little better than, like, the years when we weren't very good and you kind of like didn't have a lot of consistency, you had a lot of guys coming in and out. All of a sudden, those kind of role player type guys that everybody gives credit to on a good team, they don't really realize what you do, or you can't find your ways to impact the game as much when, you know, you're a rebuilding team, you're kind of playing a bunch of different guys. You don't ever kind of find that niche. But, mm-hmm, you know, I had it in that early Sonics team, and then that, you know, everybody moved on and then we rebuilt, but then getting it back here in Oklahoma City really found my niche.
You can have a long career playing that way.
Yeah, I think you, like, the main thing is just finding out what you can do and how you can stay on the floor, mm-hmm, and then you're gonna, you know, have some value, and then, you know, you just kind of build a reputation, and that's what I was able to do.
But you went to, I mean, you went to Seattle, and you really liked Seattle. You, mm-hmm, you wound up staying there, you were saying, in the off season, just living there. What was it about Seattle that stuck with you?
It's a great city, and for me, it was the first place I lived after college. So I lived in Iowa Falls, I lived in Lawrence, Kansas, and then I was living in Seattle. And Seattle had, you know, a lot to offer. I love it. There's a lot of culture there, a lot of really cool neighborhoods. You can go in like 12 or 13 different neighborhoods in the city and get a different feel. It has water, mountains. It's cool. It's cool that you can be in a city, have all the things the city has to offer, but also be in like a beautiful place. You can go, I don't do it a lot, but you could go hiking if you wanted, you can get on the water. It's a cool city, but it just kind of became home for me, as I lived there all year round for 5 years, right? It was the first place I lived after college. So I made a lot of friends, and it, you know, I've had a good experience with that city.
So when you're trying to adjust to being an NBA player in a new role there, I mean, you played for Nate early on. I mean, what was something that somebody told you that stands out as maybe a good piece of advice about how you can have a long career in the NBA?
You know, I think just like finding a way to help. And like, I don't know if it was necessarily a coach telling, it's probably comes from my dad, really. Like, my dad was a high school coach, and like anybody else, when it's not going well at your job, you're going to complain at home. So I heard him complaining about his bad teams, what they weren't doing, what he liked about guys. We'd sit and watch games together, and I learned a lot more about stuff than a lot of young kids do in terms of a lot of things in the game, like things that aren't always talked about until you get up into the higher levels, that I realized were important to playing basketball. So I think I kind of always had that mindset of like, I can do a lot of different things that help a team win, and just being able to do that stuff. And then you stay on the court longer, and then all of a sudden you get 4 layups and 8 rebounds and you have a double double, you know. Like, I've always felt like that, if I can just be solid and do these things that I'm supposed to be doing and be consistent at it, then I'll find a way to play.
When you found out the team was going to move to Oklahoma City, I mean, obviously you got a contract, you got to do what you got to do, but mm-hmm, did you want to go? I mean, did you want to go with
them? No, I didn't want to go at first. And it was, you know, it was because I was happy where I was at. And it was a tough thing for the city. I mean, it was, they sold the team and in the middle of the summer, and I don't think many people were aware that it was even a possibility that they were going to sell the team. There was some stuff with the arena that they were trying to do, but like it wasn't on anybody's radar. And then we spent another 2 seasons there. We're getting asked about it a lot. The fans were starting to not come. I mean, our team wasn't very good, but it was like, what's going to happen? We're owned by the guys in Oklahoma City.
It's tough when the fans think you're going to go.
That was just kind of a tough time, you know, and you know, playing the NBA is a privilege and it's great, but it wasn't an ideal situation as a player. So no, I didn't want to go at first. I knew that, that the fans were really good. You know, New Orleans had been here those 2 years and, you know, I'm from the Midwest and, played in Oklahoma. It wasn't anything about Oklahoma, but it was just, I liked where I was at. And, you know, people had, I said things publicly that I didn't want to go. And then, I think some people got upset with me here. But it was just, you know, it was just like,
I mean, what are you supposed to say too? Yeah, like tough, yeah, can't wait to leave. I'll see you.
I liked where I was at. You know, if you said, if the Oklahoma City Thunder were here for 40 years and then they were going to leave in a year and the players were like, yeah, I can't wait to get out of here. You wouldn't like that either. You know, like it was, but it's people don't always, you know, understand both sides of things. But so no, it was tough at first. Then we get here and we're 3-29 to start the season. But then we started to get some good energy late in the year. And then you started to see these young guys, how good they can be. And the fan support was like great from day one. That really helped out. Cause even, you know, we're down 30 in the first half some nights. Like it was tough, but like they stuck with us. And by the end we started to kind of get some confidence. And then that next year made a huge jump into the playoffs. And it's been an incredible run here.
You never know, too. You never know what a fan base is going to be like. This is a college state. It's a big on college sports. But you're right. Like from even when you go back to when New Orleans had to be there, they supported them. But I was skeptical that it would be, you know, full time team forever. They'd be that supportive. But this is a great basketball town.
Like yeah, it is. And Sam talks about it with us a lot. You know, we talk about how when you play here, you have a real responsibility to the community because you have some disadvantages in terms of other markets in the NBA. There's just not as many people. There's not like corporations that are buying a lot of these tickets. It's actually people and families buying these tickets. And it is really cool to see that the consistency, and it's like become the Thunder have just become a huge part of like the city and like the identity of the city. And you see it all everywhere you go. I mean, it seems like everybody's a Thunder fan. I know there's probably a lot of people here don't care, but it really has been cool to see. And you know, the team had a lot of success. Things could be different, you know, if we got here and struggled for 6 years, you know, who knows. But you know, that their support has been great, and then the team it's been really cool. It's been kind of a cool story, and it's been cool for me to be a part of the whole thing.
You talked briefly about that first year in Oklahoma City when you start 3-29, it looks just like it's just awful. Then there's a coaching change, and you guys start to turn things around a little bit. I mean, just in general, what was that year like, just from start to finish, when you're that bad early, and and how things kind of turned around there at the end?
It was really tough early, and it was like, you know, I touched on some of the stuff with the move. That was tough. We had a lot of players. You know, Sam was in the process of starting over, so there's a lot of trades, guys leaving, you know, new guys coming in. You know, we're moving here to a new city. We're starting from scratch. You know, we get here, there's no facility. We're playing at a Southern Nazarene College, which they were great to us, but it was just like a lot of things that normally in the NBA you come right in, you got your facility, you got some continuity, you know, kind of what. So that was tough. The start was awful. It was tough. Like it was just kind of dark days. And the thing that we always did though is we practiced and competed. And Scotty was really good at that. He knew, like when he took that job, he knew that he had to just create some sort of positivity. And by the end of the year, we had it. And we had these young guys, but then we made a trade for Tabo late in the year. And he kind of was a really nice young player that competed and played. And we just started getting more and more of these guys. And by the end, we were playing pretty well. And it was starting to get good energy. And then those practices, like, competed, like guys went hard. We went we didn't know it at the time, but it was a really cool thing to be a part of.
All right, we'll get back to Nick Collison in just a minute, but I'm doing this interview with a comfortable 3-day stubble, and I'm telling you, I couldn't be happier. But later this week, I've got to go do TV, and when I do, I've got to shave. And when I shave, the only products I use come from The Art of Shaving. Founded in New York in 1996, The Art of Shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. The Art of Shaving has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard maintenance, hair, skin, body, fragrance, you name it. they've got it. The Art of Shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients, featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of a perfect shave have been created to deliver smooth results every single day. Start by prepping the skin with their signature pre-shave oil, then create a thick, foamy lather with shaving cream applied with a shave brush. Shave, then replenish the moisture with their aftershave balm. Finish off the perfect shave with one of their five new fragrances. Each cologne has been carefully assembled for a distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. Our listeners will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping by using the promo code MANIX. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com. Use my special promo code MANIX to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for this special offer, or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of their many retail store locations near you. When you, I mean, you've seen the genesis of several great players here over the years. I mean, Kevin was here when they were still in Seattle. That was the one year there.
Kevin and Jeff.
Yeah, Kevin and Jeff, too. With Kevin in particular, could you tell right away, I mean, he was, remember, that was the year he was the second pick in the draft. Everybody liked Odin more. Could you tell right away that there might be something, there was something pretty special in him?
I could. He, to me, was like, for a long time, when there would be like a guy that was almost 7 feet that was pretty skilled, people would say, oh, he handles the ball like a guard. Mm-hmm. They don't really. They like handle it, you know, they have skills. But Kevin was the first one who moved and played like a real guard. Like, he could handle the ball and pick and roll, come off pin downs. Like, you could see that he moved like in his size, it was special. But he was very, I don't think I really saw the type of player he could be until that next year in Oklahoma City, late in the year, was when he really started to get some more confidence and really figure out, you know, how to simplify his game a little bit. But that first year he had a hard time. I mean, he was playing like the two.
That never made any sense to me.
And he was, you know, he didn't move as well as he does now. Wasn't as strong. These little guys would be guarding him, getting underneath him, and he'd have a hard time handling the ball. But you could see like the skill set was there, and he worked very hard at it. You could see that too. Like, his approach was great. But then he really got it going then that next year, and you could see the guy was going to be really special.
And that was when Russ came in, and Russ was a top three pick, but a lot more questions about Russ when he first came in. Could he be a point guard? What position did he play? I mean, he wasn't a consensus three at all. Kind of a risk there in some ways at that pick. I mean, what did you see in him early on?
Just like you see now, just force. Like, the first time I saw him was playing pickup in that gym, the Southern Nazarene College. And he just was like the force that he played with, just nonstop. I mean, he's wild. Like, people think he's a little wild now. Like, he was really wild back then with the ball, like some of the stuff he was doing. But you know, competitor, a lot of the things you see now, you know. But you just saw it was like another guy, like, oh, this is another like special type player. And you know, it took him a while to figure things out, you know, and point guard position's tough. This guy's both, I mean, made a lot of mistakes too, but you could see that the talent was there and more competitors.
You guys developed from that point pretty quickly. You know, that a couple of years later, you're in the playoffs against the Lakers. I remember talking to Scott and to others about just that series, and just you guys were so young and going up against, you know, the formidable team to beat, the soon to be champion at that point. And you're taking games off them. Like, you're, what was it, even up at one point in that series? I mean, what was that whole series like, being this? I mean, you were a good team. I think you were at 50 wins or something like that, and to get to the playoffs as the eighth seed. But, you know, going up against the Lakers, what was that whole series like?
It was when we came out for that first home game. I mean, I can't remember how games one and two went. I know we lost. I think maybe one of them was close and they handled us in the other. And we came out for that first home game. Like, the fans were all in their seats, like when we ran out with like 20 on the clock, loud chant. Like, it was crazy. It was like nothing else I'd ever been. I mean, Allen Fieldhouse is awesome, and it's crazy loud. So those two were like on par with each other, but it was like, it was unbelievable. I think the coolest thing about that was you saw that our team, like, we made a lot of mistakes, but we didn't back down. And these young guys didn't back down from anybody. And to see, like, how young, like you said, how, I mean, Russell was probably, I mean, if Kevin was 19, he was probably 20, mm-hmm. and Russell was probably 20.
And Harden right around there too.
Yeah, and Serge.
you were an old man.
Like, yeah, I was.
Like 27 or whatever.
I was probably 30, mm-hmm. 29, 30. But we just competed and we just battled, you know, and that was fun. And we played extremely hard back then. And if we can go back and watch, and that's the thing that really sticks out to me is how hard we played and how hard we competed. Serge is flying around and everyone's just going at it. We're making, like I said, making mistakes, but it was cool to be a part of that.
When you are, you know, an elder statesman on a team like that with young guys that are so talented. I mean, what do you see as your role, not just on the court, but like off the court in the locker room? I mean, mm-hmm. do you take any more leadership responsibility type of stuff on that type of team?
For me, I was kind of transitioning because I felt like I was still kind of a young player. I mean, I guess I was approaching 30 then, but
still young in this league. Yeah. Just not on that team.
Right. Yeah. So I started to find myself in those scenarios where I could try to help. You know, I think just trying to find ways to talk to guys to help and where I could. You know, I was still trying to prove myself. But I think the biggest thing for me that I really enjoyed was, like, I got in the league. We had a really good team. We went to the playoffs. And then we were bad for a long time. And it was exciting to be on a team like that. And I really appreciated that again. And, like, I had appreciation for what it's like when you're on a team that in March, you know, you're not going to playoffs, to be on a team that you can play in the playoffs. And then every year we seem to progress after that. I went to Western Conference Finals after that, then the finals. And I really appreciated that I could be on one of those teams. Not a lot of guys can be on one of those teams that has a chance to play late in the playoffs.
When you started winning games in that series, when you started winning games against the Lakers, I mean, at what point did that locker room think, all right, we can win this? Or was it like,
yeah,
I don't know,
just like probably an unknown, but we were just going to compete. Like we knew we were going to play hard and go at them. And I think game five, they kind of got real physical with us and, you know, like handled these young guys. And we weren't really ready for that. Like the physicality of like, you know, what a game five was like, you know, all those things we're learning for the first time. It's our first time being in the playoffs. And, I don't know. I don't know if we really thought we could, but I don't think we were thinking, we just playing, you know. It's like, that was the beauty of like back then. It's just guys are just like competing, going at it, you know, and then whatever happens, happens.
Did you ever think about, like it's media talks about it all the time, but just how good that team could have been if everything circumstances happen that guys get mm-hmm. traded, but just how good that team would have been over the years.
Yeah. I mean, it's everybody talks.
It's gotta be hard not to.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's like, yeah.
Plus, one thing I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but people always say that like James eventually would have wanted his own team and do whatever. James liked being a sixth man. Mm-hmm. Like James was, and maybe that would have changed, yeah. But James was good with.
Yeah. Things change. Like that's mm-hmm. one thing you learn about the NBA is like, whatever's happening today in 2 years is going to seem totally different. Mm-hmm. All around the league, the landscape's going to change. Everything's going to change. And it's the way, you know, we've had a ton of success since then. You know, last year was seen as like a down year for us, but we were, you know, fifth seed in the playoffs. Like we've had a lot of success here. And I think that the ownership front office deserves a lot of credit for that. Like it's not easy to be, you know, it's been 9 years now of pretty successful basketball here. That's not easy to do. So, but yeah, I mean, in the finals with those guys, they're all 21, 22. Like that's unheard of, you mm-hmm. know, to go through the fire of the playoffs and like learn and be tested and like get through teams, like win a series, move on to the next, like all those were huge steps and they felt like big steps at the time. And I think we always would run into a team that would be more mature, would play smart, would not fall apart where we would fall apart. Like that always happened at some point because we're so young, you know, we hadn't been there. But yeah, I think just with experience, if there was a way to keep everybody together, it would have been a lot of fun, but it's just not the way it works, man.
Yeah. No,
you know, it's just it's the way it goes.
Every team goes through it. Uh-huh. And you did have to go through it again two summers ago when Kevin leaves. And what did you think at that point? Like, what's going to happen with the team? What was your thoughts there?
It was a definite, James got traded. That was a big deal. But when Kevin left, it definitely felt like, okay, this is like a different thing now, because mm-hmm. we had so much continuity for a long time with kind of the main guys. And then obviously him leaving, it's a huge thing.
Did it surprise you?
I knew there was a chance he would leave. I didn't know what he would do. I thought that the way the season ended, I thought that he would stay. But, I felt like that team would be appealing to him, as it would for most players. I mean, they had a ton of success, and they play a fun brand of basketball. I guess I didn't know what he would do. I there were times throughout the year I thought maybe he would when things weren't going well, and then at the end of the year when we played so well in the playoffs, I thought he would stay, but I always knew it was going to just come down to him and what he wanted to do. So it was definitely a gut punch for us when it happened, and changed things a lot. But I think we've recovered pretty well.
What got you to recover? Like, Russ's play was ridiculous last mm-hmm. year. I mean, that was. But was there? Did you come into the training camp with kind of the right attitude? Was it something that
Russ
that
did? Russ came in. And he really wanted to set a tone. And I think a lot of everybody else is kind of looking around like, what's going to happen now? We got a lot of new faces. Like, this is obviously a different thing now. But he really set that tone, like, from day one, and being vocal and understanding, like, he was steering the ship. He was going to be the one that was going to have to lead the team, and really took that on. And I remember thinking, I'm wondering if this was going to last all year or if this was, like, him trying this out. But it really did. Ever since, he's taken control, and mm-hmm. it's been fun to see. And he's been getting better as a player all these years and does incredible things, but it's really been fun to see him grow up and really become an incredible leader. And just, I mean, he leads the whole organization. It's like he knows the responsibility he has, and it's been fun to see. And he's, like, totally embraced that. And, it's he's all grown up. It's cool. I feel like his big brother. That's seeing him grow up. It's been fun.
How would you describe him as a teammate? Because I was telling some of the PR people here, like, I've basically given up trying to do stories on Russell Westbrook. He doesn't want to be open with media. That's fine. Like, it's his mm-hmm. life. And but the thing, what people see on the outside is a very guarded type of guy, quiet. How is he on the other side?
Mm-hmm. He I think he's like very principled. Like, if he believes something should be a certain way, he believes it, and he doesn't make compromises. And he can demand a lot from teammates, but it's just like black and white with him. It's either there's a right way to do it, and you should do it that way. And I think it's a good way to be. He doesn't give in, and you see it on the court. Like, when he competes, like, he I don't know, he's always ready to go every night. As a player, like, that's what you really want. You really want guys that are just going to go battle every night, and that's what he does. And he's learned to really manage the team with the leadership stuff, but also on the court. He sees everything. He's able to figure things out. And last year he had to do a lot for us, and I think he did a good job of that. And, he'd take a lot of shots, and sometimes people would say, say things about it or whatever, but that's what he felt like he had to do. And I think this year he's going to figure out how to play with this team too. And I just have a ton of confidence that he's going to be able to figure out whatever it is.
How long do you think this team's going to take to figure each other out? Because, throwing this many guys together, one just like 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. Major names. How long do you think that's going to take?
I don't know. Everybody in the league feels good right now, I think.
Everybody's going to win a championship.
Yeah, I think.
Except in the Eastern Conference, where like five teams don't want to play.
I think the good thing about it is the guys all know how to play. So, like, we're adding a lot of veteran guys that really know how to play basketball and can figure things out. And they all seem to have, really be in the right place in terms of, like, I'm here to win. And I think they're excited about it, all our new guys. They're excited to be here. They're excited to play with this team. And The guys who were here before are excited about it. So I think guys are going to be willing to do what it takes to figure it out. I think there's stuff that on the court you just got to figure out. It takes time, so I don't know how long it'll take. But I think we're off to a good start. And the test for us is going to be think when things don't go so well. That's the test for every team, is like, how are you going to handle if you lose three in a row or whatever it is. But I think we got enough experience, and the guys, like I said, hearts are in the right place. I think we can figure that stuff out when it comes.
Have you and Melo discussed the 03 Final Four?
The media asked me about it on media day. Always the media. Yeah.
Damn us.
But no, not really. it's been a long time. Yeah, every March it stings, though. You know, and that's when it really hurts for me, is when you watch the tournament and then you see the teams at the end win it. And, we were close, but they earned it. It was more Jerry McNamara than Melo. He had like 6 threes in the first half. Melo played well. I think he was like 9 for 20, but McNamara is the one who killed us. And then myself missing free throws. We missed a lot of free throws as a team, but it's one that's the hardest one I've ever had. That's the one that stings the most. Every year gets a little easier, but
you'd think after 15-16 years, you'd be okay. You can
I'm at peace with it now. For a long time, it was really hard, but I you start to get more perspective as you get older and you realize that's who you were at that time, and play as hard as you could, but it just didn't go our way.
All right, so before I let you go, who plays longer, LeBron James or Nick Collison?
Oh, I think LeBron. I think he's like still at an MVP level. I had 62 DMPs last year, so I think it's pretty obvious he's going to outlast me.
Is this it for you this last season? What's next then? What's your post plan? Because you've been part of this organization for so long. Is it stay around here? Is it?
I don't know. I think I'd have a lot to offer in basketball. I think I've learned a lot. I think I can help. With me, I've got to make sure I get my personal life balanced. So I have an 11-year-old daughter. I'm divorced. She's not living with me. Her mother and I, we do a great job of co-parenting, and I see her as much as I can, but it's hard to be away. So I want to be where she's at and be able to give her what she needs. I've been missing a lot over the years. So if there's something I can do with that, then great. But that's the most important thing. So I don't know. I don't really have an answer, but I feel like basketball is something that I can do and be good and have a lot to offer.
Bring an expansion team to Seattle, you would be like, that'd be like two cities you'd be a legend.
Who knows? They got to get arena built. But I'd love to see it for the Seattle people. They got good fans there.
No question.
Sure. I hear about it all the time. When you guys come back, I don't think we're coming back.
Somebody, maybe someday. Right. Hey, Nick, always great to catch up with you, man. Thanks for taking a few minutes to join me.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Sarah Kustok and Nick Collison for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you could download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.